Until now, Illinois governors haven't had to disclose their staff salary. Here's Comptroller Susana Mendoza.
Democrats and Republicans alike acknowledge that as public servants, our job is to be transparent as possible. Anyone who lives in Illinois should know how Illinois taxpayer dollars are being utilized.
The Better Government Association's Madeline Dubek joins us to talk about transparency. And two teenagers from Bloomington just got back from a national shooting championship. Here's 17-year-old Jaden Thompson speaking to WGLT about why she loves the sport.
It's just you when you're on the gun. It's no one else. So it's about very extreme focus, which I really enjoy.
Plus, as you get ready to get your kids off to school and college, are you thinking about all of those costs? Up first, we're taking your questions about financial planning for your family. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, and we'll get started on the 21st just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, more on that government salary transparency law that Governor Rauner just signed. Also, we continue our Illinois Bicentennial coverage with a discussion about the state's top artists and architects. And two young women who just won a national shooting competition join us. But first, if you're a parent, this is the time of year when you're getting ready to send your kids back to school or maybe in some cases off to college. And whether that's a private or public option, there are costs involved. So we thought today would be a good time to help you with any questions you might have when it comes to financial planning for families. So when it comes to money in future planning for your family, what do you want to know? Do you need advice for the best strategy? Do you have specific questions for us? We've got two financial planners here to answer your questions, but our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to us at 21STShow. I want to welcome back to the 21st Ben Franklin, who's a certified financial planner and CPA with Franklin Wealth Advisors in Urbana. Hi, Ben. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you. My pleasure.
Tammy Winters also on the line with us from RW Financial Planning in Lincolnshire, northwest of Chicago. Hi, Tammy. Thanks for being with us as well.
Nyala, thanks very much for having us.
Ben, let's start with you. I wanted to just talk about how we can, I think in a little bit, we can talk a little bit more about the whole idea of how to talk to kids about money, because that's a whole other topic. But first, I wonder if we could start with the adults and what parents should be considering. Last time when you joined us, it was tax time. So I wondered if we should start there with family tax credits. What are some family tax credits that should be available to people, especially this time of year? What do families need to keep in mind when they're thinking about child care, tuition, other receipts they need to keep on hand?
We've got four main tax credits that are available to families that relate to their children. The first one is the Child Independent Care Credit. And I would share with you that whether you take this credit or whether you have it taken out through a cafeteria plan has to do with the tax bracket that you're in. If a person's in a lower tax bracket, for instance, if the family income is $100,000 or less, they're likely in a 12% marginal tax bracket, they're going to be better off paying the expenses themselves and taking the credit on their tax return because it will be worth at least 20% to them. But if they're in a higher tax bracket, they may very well be better off taking it through a cafeteria plan. But that's the first one.
Can
that's
you
available.
Explain what a cafeteria plan is for people who've never heard of that? It's complicated.
We might have heard it described as a Section 125. It's an employee benefit. An employer either offers it or they don't. It sometimes uses a 401k. It often will use child independent care expenses. It sometimes will include some medical expense reimbursement. But what I would say to you is if you're unsure if you have access to a cafeteria plan or not, ask your HR director. They'll know for sure.
And Tammy, is this a good time of year also to just check in with HR about other tax credits, financial planning that your employer, are there other things we should be asking our employers when it comes to families and saving money?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that families have access to, of course, is their flexible spending accounts, their health savings accounts, and as Ben was mentioning, other dependent care accounts. So understanding first if people even have access to those, if they have contributed funds to those, dollars that they may have left in those plans, it's a great time of year to check in and understand what benefits they have remaining to make sure that they take full advantage of them prior to the end of the year.
And Tammy, when we're thinking about those FSAs, is that something where you can set aside as a tax benefit, say, childcare costs, and you can put that into a flexible spending account?
Absolutely. So there's both a flexible spending account that is medical expense related, and then there's often a health and, a dependent care expense account that can also be funded to cover things like after-school care, camps, and things like that.
And Ben, remind us why this is a good tax benefit for families.
Because the it will either reduce your taxable income or it will increase the size of your refund, depending on whether or not you're doing it through this flexible spending account or whether you're doing it as a tax credit on your own Form 1040.
We're speaking with Ben Franklin and Tammy Wenner about financial planning, specifically when it comes to families. And they are here to answer your questions if you have them. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Ben, you were mentioning a couple things. So we were talking about dependent credits. There were a couple other things you wanted to mention.
The next one that I was going to mention was a child tax credit. It greatly increased this year. There's really nothing that a parent needs to do to qualify for the child tax credit, although if there's a split family situation, the parent that has custody for more than 6 months is the one that gets to claim it. But it was $1,000 in 2017 and previous years, and now it's $2,000. A slight difference, though, is some credits are refundable, and some credits can only be used to reduce income taxes. This $2,000 is broken into two pieces. $600 can be used to reduce income taxes, but the other $1,400 is refundable, and it's available for every child under the age of 17.
And that's not confusing at all, right?
Let's say to somebody that does a lot of tax returns, it's not. But
no,
I'm
you
sorry
explained
if I'm
it well. You explained
language.
It well. No, you explained it well. I was just thinking the way that it was set up was a little confusing.
Oh, yes.
I think you did a great job of explaining. And then there are also other things like the earned income tax credit, right?
Absolutely.
That is a good thing for people to remember this time
it
of year.
It is the most valuable credit of all. And as a side note, is also the greatest point of fraud with the Internal Revenue Service, and great steps are being taken to make sure that people are actually claiming children that really do qualify. But the credit can be huge, as much as $6,318 for a family with three children.
And this is primarily for lower-income working families.
Well, and what I would say to you is lower income has kind of changed, because if you went back to the early days of the earned income tax credit, the credit was available up to an income level, if I remember correctly, around $34,000. Now it's almost $54,000 is the limit.
That's so a lot of working families.
Yeah, it qualifies for a lot of low middle class families.
Mm-hmm. This is also, Tammy, with the earned income tax credit, we think some of the issue has in the past has been a lot of families weren't aware of it. As Ben was saying, because it was maybe in the $30,000 range, maybe some families didn't even file income taxes. Is this something where financial planners are reminding all families this is a good credit to remember because it's basically money they're leaving on the table?
Absolutely. And in fact, for some families, it might make sense to go back and file an income tax return if they haven't done so in the past, simply to take advantage of this credit. So definitely something to look out for. And for many families, a $6,000 check coming back to them can be quite meaningful in terms of paying down debt or saving for retirement, maybe for a new home. So it's a very material amount of money.
Yeah. And as we're thinking about saving, Tammy, I wanted to ask you about college because that's a big expense. There's lots of different saving strategies over the years. Can I start by asking when you think parents should begin the process of saving for college for their kids if that's something they want to do?
Yeah. So ideally, probably as soon as a child is born, if not before. But I think the caveat to that is to understand how college savings fits in with the family's overall plan, and in particular, making sure that the family has already an emergency fund and or the parents have started saving for their own retirement. I think those two things need to be identified and looked at first. If then it makes sense to start saving for college, then certainly a 529 plan, which is a tax advantage plan to save for future college expenses, is a great opportunity to build some college savings.
Mm-hmm. And when we're thinking about, Ben, just the whole idea of the philosophy behind this, and I think this has changed and different families approach this in different ways, how do you think couples should talk about the responsibility of figuring out, is this something, are we going to try to create a savings account for our kids for college? Oftentimes when we're thinking about student debt, we have situations where parents are still paying off their own debt maybe while sending their kids to college. How do you recommend families have this conversation?
Boy, this gets back to family values, and it is so tough because it varies across so many families. But I think that it is important that this gets put in the proper place within the overall family values. So, like, if I could come from the standpoint of we had four boys. Now, this may be totally prejudicial. I think I would have treated girls based on three granddaughters differently than I would have treated boys if I had raised them. But we expected the boys to have skin in the game, because if they didn't have skin in the game, we didn't think that they were going to get anything out of what they were doing. So we would match some of their savings for college that they might get from work, but we had no intention of footing the whole bill. And because of our family dynamics in the 90s when we were saving up for college and actually going back to the late 80s, Parkland was a viable solution for us. And we had intended to use a community college for 2 years and then have them transfer to a four-year school. But you also have to understand, Nyla, and I don't know what your background is, but I had a very non-traditional educational route. And so I don't understand the value of spending 4 years at a university and building up all of the social contacts that you do. So a parent that has had the value from that might have a different perspective, and they might handle their finances differently than I would.
Tammy, how do you approach having this conversation with families? As Ben's saying, it is really individual and unique. Probably every family comes from a different situation when it comes to college and paying for it.
Absolutely. And an interesting point to that is the family also has a split dynamic when it comes to that. Very often, if I'm speaking with a married couple, one spouse may have the thought that they intend to pay for 4 years of school wherever the child may wish to go. And another parent, to add to Ben's comments, may feel that, no, that's completely not necessary. The child should have some skin in the game, and maybe a two-year community college makes sense. So the first part of any type of discussion about this is to really get a sense of what the family is thinking first, and then also to understand if, depending upon the child's age, how have they started communicating this with the child. And, you know, if it's a child that's a preteen or a teen and starts to have a basic understanding of money, letting them be involved in the conversation and understand how much the cost is and what the family may have to give up to save for college, depending upon the goals. And so just starting the conversation with understanding, again, to add to Ben, kind of what the values are and what the family is thinking about, understanding that with there's two parents, they often have very different views on how to proceed.
And when we think about that, Ben, I wonder, I imagine you would suggest that that's not the first conversation you have with your kids about money is when they're preteens and teens and saying, by the way, we want you to pay for college. Yes. When do you think these conversations should start?
Oh, I'm going to date myself a little bit, but we actually started these things probably when our boys were in the 5, 6, 7 range on different kind of subjects. And those were the early days of the dollar menus at the fast food places. And we would say, we're willing to pay for X number of items. If you want one past that, then you have to pay for it yourself. And we'd give them ways to earn the money. It could be through paper routes. It could be through extra work around the home. Not the things that you do because you have the privilege of being part of the home. Like, we wouldn't pay them for picking up their room, or we wouldn't pay them for taking out trash. But we pay them for mowing the grass. We pay them for working in the garden, those kind of things. And so they learned that they needed to save up some money because they wanted to spend it on things later. And if they didn't have the money, they couldn't spend it. So if you can begin to build in those principles of delayed gratification and that there's something worth saving for at a younger age, it makes those kind of conversations a lot easier.
Tammy, do you have other strategies for introducing and talking about this, the concept of money? At what age do you think it's important to give children control over at least some of their own money?
I wholeheartedly agree with Ben, and in fact did many of the same things with my two children as well. The earlier the better, and I would also add to that to let them make mistakes. So they have $5 in their pocket and they want to buy a toy that you know is going to break within 3 minutes, or they buy candy that they're going to eat within a minute and then have no candy and no money left. I think those are great learning opportunities, and the more that they can get those experiences and make mistakes and learn from spending maybe on the wrong thing, the better, because it's only going to help them in the future when the decisions are bigger and the consequences are greater.
But I want to also, just as we're talking about this, ask you a little bit how you think money and planning changes as our concept of family has changed, because the model of one man, one woman, and 2.5 kids has really not really what America looks like these days. Last week we were talking about women being the primary breadwinner. We have same-sex couples and blended families and multi multi-generational families. Do you think new family structures mean new rules for financial planning?
I don't know that they mean new rules, but they sometimes mean new headwinds, and they sometimes mean new challenges. Because the non-traditional families will often put more financial pressure, and money will have to go further than it did before.
Especially, because there's more people in the family?
Oh, I was actually thinking more like maybe there's some child support that might be being paid to another.
Right.
Yes, things along those lines.
Right.
And so kind of like Tammy was talking about earlier when she talked about the balance between emergency funds, retirement, and college, I find a lot of families that are struggling using Roth IRAs because a Roth IRA still gives you access to your principal, still lets you build some dollars for retirement, and if you needed to use it for education, you could. But while you're still kind of weighing what's most important, it's a place that can meet any one of the three while you're figuring those kind of things out. But I don't find that the rules have necessarily changed. I just find, again, that there are more challenges with it.
And Tammy, to Ben's point about a Roth IRA, are there other flexible saving vehicles that you can recommend just as we wrap up here?
I think just having a basic, going back to the whole emergency fund, one of the things that kind of derails a financial plan is when people need to go into debt to pay for things. And certainly in a well-funded or as well-funded as it can be, emergency fund can help with minimizing the need to go into debt. So that's certainly the most flexible and the most liquid type of account to have. And then if that's properly funded, certainly a non-retirement specific investment account can also be a good option to save for the future, but then if needed, tap into those funds for larger expenses going forward.
Lots to think about. I want to thank Tammy Wenner for being with me with RW Financial Planning, Ben Franklin with Franklin Wealth Advisors. Ben, Tammy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thanks.
Nyla, thanks for the opportunity to share. Take care.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a public official, your salary is public knowledge. At least that's what we expect. It's easy, for example, to look up the salaries of everyone at the University of Illinois because it's a public university. But it turns out this hasn't been the case for those working in the governor's office. This has been true throughout the years for governors of both parties. That is until last week when Governor Rauner signed a bipartisan bill that requires full public disclosure of staff salaries in his office. Here to explain more is Madeline Dubek, Vice President of Policy for the Better Government Association. Hi, Madeline. Welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, great to be with you.
Madeline, how is it possible that salaries of the governor's staff weren't public information until now?
Well, technically, the salaries within the office of the governor were public, and the what's happening here is that the governor engages in a practice called offshoring, in which he attaches some of his top advisors' salaries to other agencies within state government. Technically, all of those agencies are under the jurisdiction of the governor, but it is a way of kind of putting people in the shadows and making their jobs and what they're up to and the salary information and how much the governor is spending on top executives somewhat shadowy.
And this is something I know that has happened with governors of both parties, correct? This isn't just an issue
is
with
correct.
Our most recent governor, Rauner.
Comptroller Susana Mendoza introduced the Truth in Hiring Act. She made a point of noting that previous governors, Governor Quinn, Governor Blagojevich, Republican Governor George Ryan, all engaged in this practice, and that she believed it was time to stop, and that people ought to have a more clear and direct understanding of who the governor is hiring for what job and how much that office is spending on salaries. And so as it turns out, when she first introduced this legislation, she said you know, if you took a look in the governor's part of the budget, you would think that he had 40-some staffers and was spending about $4 million on them. It turns out that the budget is actually closer to 60 people and $10 million. So,
that's,
you know, that's
a big difference.
Important to know. That's, you know, there were more people in other agencies and being kind of their salaries being obscured than were actually listed in the governor's office budget.
And Madeline, do we think this was happening because the governor wants people in it? Well, it's been his, because it's, we've had male governors in his, on his staff. Maybe they're bringing them in from the private sector or other places, but they really want those people. So they're willing to pay maybe higher than your typical government salary for them. And that's why we've had this practice of putting them in different agencies and kind of spreading that money around.
I think that certainly has been the case with Governor Rauner. If you reach back in your memory bank to when he was first campaigning for office, he talked a lot about how he was going to bring in all kinds of superstars from the private sector and was going to have the best team in America working for him. And, you know, it costs money to attract top-level talent like that who can you know, garner great salaries in the private sector. So I'm sure that that was all part of a political calculation, because the governor also wanted to be able to campaign on the idea that he's holding the line on spending and is running an efficient government.
And now in this campaign year, Governor Rauner can say that he signed this bipartisan bill that requires full public disclosure. This bill passed, Madeline, with just 7 no votes in the Senate. I guess my question to you is, do we have a sense of why this took so long for this to happen?
You know, I think it just wasn't really something that became an issue of focus and concentration until Comptroller Mendoza brought it up. And she has been a dogged critic of the Republican governor. And this was, you know, something that I think obviously Democrats and Republicans thought was a good long overdue move in favor of transparent government. Now, when Governor Rauner signed the bill into law, he made the point that it really ought to apply to all of the statewide constitutional officers. I'm not quite sure, you know, where those other offices are not, they don't govern as many things as the governor does, so there may be fewer places for them to hide people. But I would, you know, point out that perhaps we should now focus on some transparency in the state budget in general. We have a long, sorry history in the state of Illinois of passing a budget on the last days of session, hundreds of pages of spending that even many legislators will tell you they haven't read and don't know the details of, and lots of spending gets tucked in there on things that many of us would consider questionable.
And I wanted to ask you just a general question about that. I wonder how important laws like this are to help with the overall climate of government transparency. In general, how would you rate our state government as far as transparency goes?
Oh, I think we have a long way to go to improve. I think there are lots of things like the budget transparency that I just mentioned that we could be doing. I think that we are seeing now a movement toward wanting more transparency at all levels of government. We've seen just in the past couple of months a few high-profile severance arrangements with some public top executives, one of them being the president of Southern Illinois University. And we don't always know the details of those arrangements and why they come to pass. And so I think there's a lot more that Illinois and its various governments could be doing to become more transparent.
And how important do you think transparency is when it comes to issues like spending or maybe even other further issues like corruption?
Oh, I think that knowledge is power, and we need to have as much truthful, factual information as we possibly can out there. And, you know, it seems as if every legislative session in Springfield, the Better Government Association's policy unit in particular, is having to fend off legislation that would put holes in the Freedom of Information Act in particular, which is one of the foremost tools that the public and journalists use to try to get more factual information about our government and our activities. And so we need to really fight to preserve the strength of those pieces of legislation.
That's Madeline Dubik. She's Vice President of Policy for the Better Government Association, talking to us a little bit more about government transparency, especially when it comes to the governor's office and this bipartisan bill signed last week. Madeline, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Nyla. Take care.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're continuing to celebrate our state's 200th anniversary this year, along with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. The museum's been releasing a series of top 10 lists for everything Illinois. This time around, it's best Illinois artists, but there are lots of architects and sculptors on this list. So to talk about this, not only do we have Chris Wills, the museum's communication director, on the line with us from Springfield, but we've got Doug Stapleton here with us as well. He's an associate curator of art with the Illinois State Museum. Hi, Chris. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Hello. Hi.
Good morning. Chris, let me start with you. Every time we talk to you about these lists, we're learning a little bit more about Illinois as the state celebrates its 200th, its bicentennial. What have you learned about Illinois? What did you learn about Illinois specifically through this list of artists and architects and sculptors?
Well, I guess each time we research a different category, I find people that I am familiar with but didn't realize they had a strong Illinois connection, so that's great. And then I find people I've never heard of before, but they're really fascinating, and it's a pleasure to get to know that little piece of Illinois history that I'm unfamiliar with. So there's just so much there to explore.
Okay, so we're going to get into some of those names and explore as we get to the winners. Doug, I wanted to ask you, I think it's notable that out of the 10 artists, four of them are architects. Is that surprising to you or not so much?
It's not surprising. Illinois and certainly the metropolitan Chicago area is known for its architectural heritage and actually kind of the birth of the modern skyscraper. It's something that we can claim that right. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
And then as we're talking about architecture in Chicago and Illinois, there's the number one name that should ring a bell for listeners, even if they're not architecture buffs. That's Frank Lloyd Wright. Doug, I wonder if you can remind us of why you think he belongs as number one on this list.
Well, he is was based out in Oak Park, had his studio in Oak Park, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. And his work in the state and also around the country and around the world really set a standard for modern architecture, moving out of an arts and crafts sensibility into a modern world of cast concrete and glass and streamlined design. He encompasses so much of what we think about of American architecture. And he, as a personality, as an individual, had a very colorful life. He was the inspiration for other architects, for writers, for so many people. So I think his name at the top of the list is not a surprise.
Doug, I was just in Scotland on vacation. It was so interesting to go to Glasgow to the Charles McIntosh House and see such similarities between Charles McIntosh and Frank Lloyd Wright and sort of see that across as we see that architecture and those schools across the world. I wonder if you can think of another everyday example of Frank Lloyd Wright's impact on our lives today.
Oh, well, let's see. What we refer to as the Prairie School. I think if you drive around Illinois and you look around, actually maybe across the country, I think he had a very profound influence on how we look at the suburban home, the sort of long, low, streamlined house with, single story. Just that look was a very right idea, I think. And that's why he influenced so many. I mean, that's why I think he's so important when we talk about American architecture.
Mm-hmm. Chris, when we think about Frank Lloyd Wright and its architecture, his architecture, certainly there are places all across the state where you can go to see this. Chris, I wonder where are your favorite places to go? Is it Oak Park and all of those in that neighborhood?
You can't argue with how wonderful the Oak Park area is for Frank Lloyd Wright, but my favorite is right here in Springfield. It's the Dana Thomas House. It's one of the earlier major commissions that he did, and it's beautiful in and of itself, but what really sets it apart is it's got almost all the original furniture, lights, art glass, and other decorative items that he designed himself. So it's a Frank Lloyd Wright home inside and out, and it's just beautiful.
So let's go to another name on the list. That's Lewis Sullivan. And anyone who's been, I think, to the old Carson Perry Scott building in downtown Chicago on State Street, which is now a Target, may recognize those beautiful Sullivan doors. Doug, what else can we talk about with Lewis? How else can we think about Lewis Sullivan's influence in Chicago?
Well, his influence is, well, he was influential on Frank Lloyd Wright. I think in many ways Wright might have been working to outdo Sullivan. But when we look at things like the Auditorium Theater in Chicago, when we look at that kind of wonderful, sweeping Romanesque style arch with natural sort of organic forms, flowers and plants, that sort of marriage of architectural history and the Midwest landscape, that's Sullivan. That's what comes to mind for me.
Mm-hmm. So there were 20 nominees and 10 that made the final list. Doug, are there people who you think absolutely should be on the list? I was wondering about, for example, Daniel Burnham.
The list could have been 100 names. Burnham, I think, for architectural planning, yes. But somebody like Edgar Miller, who was an arts and crafts architect in Chicago, much more sort of homegrown and down to earth, smaller interiors, smaller spaces. He did furnishings, textiles, graphic design. I would love to see him on the list. Actually, I probably didn't mention him to Chris originally because there were just so many names going through all of our heads. We're bound to miss somebody, but sort of think about them in retrospect. So I would put Edgar Miller on that list, and hopefully everybody will now go and Google Edgar Miller and find out how cool his work is.
Right. Chris, who are your personal favorites who are on the list?
Aside from some of the ones we've discussed already, I think Olaf Kranz, to me, is the most fascinating. He grew up in the religious community of Bishop Hill in the 1840s and 50s, and then later in his life, without any formal training, he began painting scenes of what his childhood was like in that little village. And the work he produced, I think, is just fascinating. It's a little awkward. The figures are a little stiff, but it's full of rich, rich color. And it sort of has this kind of dreamlike look to it, a sort of him dreaming of his life in a little farming community 50 years earlier.
That's right, because we haven't really, we've been talking about architects, we haven't talked about artists. Chris, any other artists that we should be thinking about that ended up on the list as well?
I think that depending on what you mean by artist, the photographer Vivian Mayer is an amazing person. She ranked at number 9 on the list. She did street photography for decades, mostly in Chicago, some in New York and Los Angeles, and kept all her work to herself for the most part. And it was only after her death that these thousands and thousands of negatives were discovered and people realized what an amazing talent she was. So I personally can just look at her street photography for hours. She just captures so perfectly individuals in their environments.
Right. So lots of names for people to think about as we celebrate Illinois' bicentennial, its top artists and architecture. I want to thank Chris Wills with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, Doug Stapleton for joining us as well with the Illinois State Museum. The next on the list is top actors, right, Chris?
That's right. We've got people like Marlon Brando, Dick Van Dyke, Andre Brower.
Yeah, Gary so Metcalf. Lots of them to vote. Thanks so much for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What sports were you playing when you were 16 or 17? Maybe football, baseball, or volleyball were a big part of your life, but perhaps not competitive rifle or pistol shooting. Students from Central Illinois Precision Shooting have been training for years to hit a bullseye almost too small to see on a target more than 30 feet away. And teenage athletes like Jaden Thompson and Martina Grotz from the Bloomington Gun Range participated recently in the USA Shooting Rifle Pistol National Championships in Fort Benning, Georgia. Both Jaden and Martina were part of a team that won the three-position team championship in June. They're joining me now on the line from WGLT, along with their coach and director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting, Joe Miller. Jaden, Martina, Joe, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And congratulations, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Martina, let me start by asking you, I do think one of the things Martina and Jaden, you and I were talking about before we went on air was the fact that a lot of people may not be even familiar with this sport. So can you first start by telling us just about the actual sport of competitive shooting?
So competitive shooting has three positions: prone, standing, and kneeling. And prone, you basically just lay on the ground and you just shoot. And standing, it's pretty self-explanatory. You just stand. And then kneeling, you just kneel on the ground and shoot. And so at 50 feet, the target, well, the bullseye, is about the size of smaller than a dime. And then at 100 yards, you're aiming for what's the size of a quarter. And to be competitive, you have to shoot that dime or quarter 99% of the time.
Wow. And so, Martina, how many hours are you spending practicing?
I train, I would say for sure 12 hours a week.
Jaden, when did you first get involved in competitive shooting? This is something you first came to as part of 4-H?
That's right. I started shooting about 4 years ago.
And what drew you to it?
Well, I heard about air rifle through 4-H, and I was really interested, so I tried it out, and then Joe recruited me for the CIPS team, and I started shooting precision air rifle, and I really enjoyed it, so I kept with it.
And Joe, I wonder when students usually start with you who are interested in becoming competitive shooters. I know when we talked to you in the past that you have kids. At what age do you start? Is it around 10 or 11 or a little older?
We start about 10 or 11, and it's usually the kids that work at it because they're competitive, but they're not big enough or fast enough to really be competitive in team sports, yet they're motivated to work at something. And to see them set a goal like these two, to set a goal and be willing to work for it, put the effort into it. It is amazing how much time they work and practice.
Jaden, how about you? How much hours a week do you spend practicing?
I usually spend around 2 or 3 hours a night training, whether that's actually shooting or setting goals and putting together training plans.
And how do you do that? What kind of things do you do to train for competition if you're not shooting?
Well, I work a lot on the mental side as well, so I read books. And I set goals in perspective, so I don't want to set too high of goals. And for air rifle, we shoot 60-shot strings, so I break my goals into 10-shot strings for each match to keep my goals a little bit smaller and more focused.
And Jaden and Martina, both of you, I think a lot of kids take up sports for a little bit and then maybe they try something else, like maybe they play soccer for a while and they play basketball. This is something both of you have stuck with it for years now. Jaden, it's been 3 or 4 years for you as well as for you, Martina, right? Jaden, what has made you stick with this?
I think there's something different about the atmosphere in this. I'm not really sure what it is. It might be because it's more individual, and I think the fact, Martina mentioned this earlier when we were talking, we get to shoot with Olympians, but if you're shooting next to Olympian on the line, the shooters that are competing, that doesn't really faze them. It's just like, oh, I'm shooting next to so-and-so. Like, at one match I shot down the line from the gold medalist Jenny Thrasher,
I thought it was cool for the first time I looked at the relay list, and then once I started shooting, I was like, she's just another competitor, so everyone's just competing. There's no, and no one's higher than anyone else.
And also, in the competition you all were in, men and women compete together, right, Martina?
Yes, that is correct. So for this match, men and women competed, and it's really funny because women have like the stereotype of not being as high up in like competitive sports, but for sure with like shooting and stuff, it's a pretty equal platform, and you really see like sometimes men women win and sometimes women win. But for this match, my sister won the overall, and that's been the first women overall winner for like for however long this match has been going on.
Wow. When for both your sister and for you guys were part of the team that won, as I mentioned, the three position team championship. How did it feel to win, you guys?
It felt pretty cool. Like, we've been working at this for 3 or 4 years, like all of us being on a team. And last year we lost a pretty key member because he aged out. And this year we really didn't know how we were going to do. And we all did really well. And once we saw that overall list, we it just like it was amazing because we had finally gotten where we wanted to get for that match, and it was pretty cool.
Joe, as you're listening to Jaden and Martina talk about what they have learned, I wonder what you think this competition teaches young people.
I think one of the most important things you heard from both of them. To find somebody, these kids were starting at 11 and 12, and to be able to set a goal and the work ethic it takes to get there, to be able to focus on something, and as a coach, to see them take the responsibility of, Jaden said it so well, you know, this is what I wanted to do. To be able to focus on setting a goal, the work ethic to work at that, to achieve success, you just don't see that in many people. You mentioned earlier the kid who tries soccer, and I don't like that, and then he tries basketball, and then he or she does this. To find something that the kids can focus on as an individual and take upon themselves that responsibility, knowing it takes 2 hours a night. I think you have here in front of us now the original, two original, what we call range rats. When the range is open, they're there shooting. They'll just do everything they can to be successful at that. And both of them are eminently coachable, too, to try something new, to reach that goal, to experiment a little bit, not be afraid of failing. You've got two very exceptional people here.
Joe, I wonder, is it different to teach young men versus women, young women?
Not in this sport, because it's easy to walk away from. Okay, I tried that and walk away. But to come back, and it's really a joy to coach, because the young people that are there, the adults that are getting into air rifle competition, they want to succeed. They want to be there. And if you can identify something to help them, they're willing to try it. So that's a different attitude in people who really want to be there and are willing to work for it. And it's a joy to see the success in them, because they sat here being a national champion. It's been a long road for them, and there's been bad days in there. And to have two young people, the five we had on the whole team, that, you know, I'll take the bad days. I'm going to learn from them. And to make a mistake, to be wrong, isn't that bad, as long as I learn from it and go forward. And at this level, that's what it takes.
I'm speaking with Joe Miller, who's the director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting and the coach for 17-year-old Jaden Thompson and 16-year-old Martina Gratz. We're talking to them about their championship win Jaden, I wanted to ask you about whether we were, I was talking to you before we're on air about how you're at Normal West High School. A lot of your classmates don't even necessarily know that you are competing in this sport at this level. And I wonder what misconceptions you think people have. I was thinking of when you were telling me earlier about how when you tell your teacher, oh, I'm not going to be in school today because I have to go to this rifle competition. Do people sometimes react oddly because they don't know what you're talking about?
Well, on the first day of school, I usually try to approach my teachers and let them know in advance that I'm going to be missing for rifle competitions. And they usually ask me a little bit about what it is, and they usually seem interested. And when my mom mentions that I am a competitive rifle shooter to some of her friends, they ask if I'm a sniper. So, no, I am not a sniper. But,
wow. That's, yeah.
Yeah, but my teachers always seem interested to learn about what I'm doing.
And Martina, what about you? I wonder how it feels when you see, especially this year, so much conversation with young people your age about gun violence and all the walkouts that we've seen. Martina, did your school have a walkout?
We did not have any walkouts. My school is very, very small. And they're all very supportive of me. I come back from shooting at the Junior Olympics at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado, and they all ask me how I do. And sometimes it gets put in the announcements that I place third in my age group. And it's pretty amazing, like, the support that's behind me, because our school is just so small, and everybody supports me no matter what we do. And I feel like especially teenagers my age and older, about like all the walkouts, they don't understand that competitive shooting is a sport. They're just focusing on like the violent side of guns, which sadly is there, but they just don't understand what we do, and they don't understand that it's a sport and it's our lives. Like, me and Jaden, our lives for the most part revolve around competitive shooting. Like, we skip school to go to Colorado, to Georgia, to Indiana pretty regularly, and you get to go to college. My sister had a full ride scholarship for competitive shooting out at West Virginia, and she couldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for competitive shooting, because it is a sport, and people my age just don't get that.
Yeah, Jaden, let's just end by, what do you want people to know about this that they may have misconceptions about?
Well, this is a precision sport. This isn't like bang-bang rifles. These are pellet rifles and .22 rifles. So really, they can't cause much harm unless you put the wrong person behind them. And I think people should just know this is a pastime sport for some people, and then, like Martina mentioned, a regular sport for some people. It's not anything bad or harmful.
And are both of you hoping to compete in the Olympics? It sounds like, is that a goal that either of you have set, Jaden?
Yes, that is a major goal of mine.
And Martina?
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely one of my major goals I have in life right now.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to speak with me. That's Martina Grotz. She's a 16-year-old along with 17-year-old Jaden Thompson, both of them teammates, part of the team that won the three-position team at the USA Shooting Rifle and Pistol National Championships. On the line with us with their coach and the director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting, Joe Miller, from our partners at WGLT. Joe, thanks for bringing Jaden and Martina to us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the time.
Ladies, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be hearing more about a documentary film that's been making waves ever since it premiered at Sundance earlier this year. It's about three young men who were skateboarders in Rockford. And one of those guys, the director and filmmaker, Bing Liu, joins us to talk about his film, Minding the Gap. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps and always find past shows there. Our website, 21stshow.org, is also the place to find past shows. Leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or if you want to follow us at social media, all you have to remember is 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. And today we want to say a special thank you to our summer intern, Tyler Panlilio, who's leaving us this week and has been with us all summer. Thanks, Tyler. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.